I mean, I like repeating myself, man. So yeah, we'll play it by ear. This is definitely the first test broadcast, and we'll see how the
we have a loose agenda for the.
Yeah, I don't want to be struck. And if something occurs,
I think we always will.
Yeah, and if something occurs to us, we can talk to them. I mean, like basketball, I at least want to mention that they're playing a big game this week.
It's true. I just realized today, actually, that we played Oklahoma, and I kind of got terrified.
Yeah, don't worry, Oklahoma just lost.
Did they?
I mean,
really?
Literally just lost, like 2 minutes ago.
I didn't watch anything tonight. I was playing Fallout 4.
Okay, see, there you go. You got to get the important things in. Well done. So, yeah, like I know you said you kind of want to do like a cold open, something like that, so I'll let you...
Here we are. This is the inaugural episode of the Sneaky Good Podcast. I keep thinking in my head it's the Pretty Good Podcast.
But no, it's not Pretty Good. It is Sneaky Good.
Sneaky Good. And that's very important.
And we're trying to avoid becoming the Auburn defense of podcasts.
True. We'll do our damnedest. But I'm Paul, Dan, whatever you want to call me. You are?
I am Poser.
Poser. I actually wanted to ask you if it's poser or posure.
Posure. No, it is poser. That is what you call people in the punk rock scene who, are big fakers. So,
as you've explained to me before.
As a big fan of irony, I like to take the ironic nickname of poser. But also, like, a blog in and of itself is kind of posing as being, like, real media.
It's true. But it has become, like, transcendent. I mean, there are, within SB Nation itself, there's even working journalists, like,
Oh, definitely. Godfrey. Yeah, it's like really Godfrey's amazing. Every day should be Saturday, of course. Spencer Hall is the gold standard. I mean, even on our site, Billy breaks stories. He's got sources. He does actual reporting. It's kind of embarrassing that he has to work with jackasses like us.
It's true. We drag him down.
We totally do. And we need to get him on this sometime.
Yeah.
Billy's no excuse. I have kids, too.
Sure he'll be one of the first guests, if not the first guest.
And I guess we should also clarify that this isn't like something that we're mad at podcast and we're trying to break away from the And the Valley Shook podcast. It's mainly that our schedules never line up. They tend to record earlier in the night when I'm trying to put all the kids to bed because I have two little kids around the block, and I know the timing never really works out well for you. So we tend to be night owls, so
That's
we can
true.
Record this late in the night.
Our schedules align, so this works out.
Yeah, so this is – hopefully this will be added value to
– We can hope so.
God, I hate all that kind of stuff. I do not like corporate speak, particularly in what I consider my hobby.
Well, let's talk about – I guess we can kick off with recruiting. Obviously, LSU just had a bunch of official visitors in town. There was no real major – transformative news to come out of that, so much as just that everyone that showed up that was considered to be probably going to LSU pretty much left with that same feeling. If anything, Christian Fulton, a defensive back that's kind of been looking at Florida and looking around from Louisiana, it seems to be people are confident that they might have shored him up. So,
well, and this is one of those things with recruiting, since so much of recruiting news is behind a paywall. Mm-hmm. It's one of the last great frontiers of journalism. But I would assume that a lot of recruiting with something like this is no news is good news.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't a whole lot of leans. I mean, there was LSU leans, but there weren't a lot of guys coming who were leans to other school. So if there was going to be news, it was going to be people flipping towards LSU until we get to, of course, the actual big news of the day.
Yeah, so the real piece of news is Dwayne Haskins, the quarterback from Maryland that Cam Cameron seems to have honed in on after losing Felipe Franks, has since committed to Ohio State, which most people thought he was headed to Ohio State. I think the abrupt decision of it all was a little bit shocking.
I saw something on Twitter today that he's been a secret commit for quite some time. And that's...
Yeah, they called him a silent.
Oh, that's painful. And then he took another player with him. I know, Jake, we need to get him off suicide watch right now.
Yeah.
I'm also from Maryland as well. So Jake is like 20 years behind me on the schedule of life. So, but I've given up on Maryland football a long time ago because I lived through the Joe Krivak era. Look that up, kids.
assignment for the night.
You just feel bad. It's almost like Ohio State is just picking on poor little Maryland. I mean, this is welcome to the big boys, because the ACC is not the SEC or the Big Ten when it comes to recruiting. And honestly, the Big Ten is not the SEC when it comes to recruiting, but Ohio State is.
Yep.
And it seems Urban Meyer has just turned his focus to just destroying Maryland.
Yeah, just poaching Haskins and then the linebacker. I'm blanking on his name.
I am as well, and I don't really follow Maryland recruiting enough.
Right, I just saw the tweets going around about him.
It almost feels like spite. Like, it feels like, you know, it's not a guy they need. The quarterback is. Haskins they certainly need. But sure. it feels more like he's more intent on destroying Maryland's class and keeping them down. And it goes kind of to Urban Meyer's philosophy, even when he's a game coach, is, you know, put the foot on the neck and, you know, break it kind of thing. Urban Meyer is a ruthless head coach. I say that with admiration, actually. I don't like Urban Meyer, but this is actually one of the things I admire about him. I mean, he is a ruthless killer.
Yeah, and I remember when he first showed up, the Big Ten, I think it's since died down some, but there was still a lot of that old school, the unwritten rules of recruiting. Like, if you're committed to another school, you no other Big Ten school is going to recruit him because honor code, you know, which is the SEC just kind of pointed and laughed at. But
and Ohio State has no honor.
Yeah, it changed with Meyer, and then obviously Harbaugh is not adhering to that either. So, and coincidentally, or not coincidentally, they're the two best recruiting teams in the conference. So,
and recruiting, as we know, aligns with actual wins and losses. Because the best recruiting team in the nation is Alabama. We can talk about process until they're blue in the face, but really, what makes that train go are the Jimmys and Joes.
Yep.
Nick Saban is quite possibly the greatest recruiter of all time. And Les, in his defense, Les is a pretty good recruiter, but his big blind spot has always been quarterbacks. Is there any reason why he can't recruit a quarterback, you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think we run into those. There's those – I don't want to use the word narrative because you and I both hate how that's used. But the story is always that the LSU offense is so podunk and, like, backwoods and can't do anything but run the ball 3 yards a carry – which really isn't that true, but I don't know if he's fighting that battle because there's still terrible offenses that get great quarterbacks all the time. I mean, Alabama wasn't exactly a bastion of offensive production until Kiffin showed up.
And also, I don't want to spoil your column that you're working on right now, but really LSU has had problems with having to rush guys onto the field right away. I don't think it's a recruiting issue so much as a roster mismanagement issue.
Yeah.
It seems like LSU is always frantically putting a freshman on the field because they lose a senior or a junior and there was no stopgap in between. And once again, it seems that we've set ourselves up for that situation in the future. Harris is a junior going in the next year, and I don't think he's going to go pro. That's getting a little bit of our head of ourselves. But let's say he even stays. You have junior, and then he's a senior. There's only one scholarship player currently who would be on the roster when Harris is a senior, and that's kind of a project in McMillan. LSU really needed a quarterback recruit in this class who doesn't necessarily have to be a star, but it had to be someone who could conceivably compete with McMillan for playing time as a bridge to the star that you're trying to get next year, because I think next year they're lined up to try and land one of the biggest quarterback recruits in the country. But once again, let's worry about 2017 when we get to 2017.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems like their recruiting philosophy in general has not trickled into quarterback, because like you said, it's just they've taken a very accumulation of bodies approach to every other place, every other position on the field. The old, like the Bill Belichick NFL model, where he's just going to accumulate 15 draft picks every draft because the more people he has to choose from, the more likely he is to find one that works. So why is that not happening at quarterback?
It seemed like they went all in on Haskins and let some other guys slip through the cracks. It didn't seem like their backup plan. And also, first they were all in on Franks, then they were all in on Haskins. And I don't really know much about Cam Cameron's reputation as a recruiter. You're much more of a recruiting guy than I am. But it seems like he doesn't have the ability to chase two rabbits at one time. Like, he just gets focused on one.
Yeah. He's done a pretty good job as a recruiter for other positions. And even when he first got here, he was largely credited for the reason that Harris wound up picking LSU over Auburn and A&M, who were both after him. And at the time were fielding these prodigious offenses that were very attractive to a high-ranking quarterback. But obviously he hasn't delivered since Harris. And the quarterback, you know, there's like, I think he's got a couple other four stars, this guy, like Steven Sullivan, the early enrollee wide receiver, and one more, I can't remember, but he's not delivering the quarterbacks, which is what we need him to do.
And yeah, that's the big problem. And really, LSU has been one of the few major programs in the country that has been able to withstand terrible quarterback play. If you look at a lot of major programs and what causes a dynasty to fall, it is, I don't want to say always, but a lot of the times, it's quarterback play. Florida State lost great quarterback play, and they slipped towards the end of the Bowden era. USC finally stopped getting Heisman winners, and they had a little slippage, even though they had other issues, you know, with the, losing pretty much every scholarship they had. You look at Texas, Mac Brown, he couldn't find that quarterback, and he also had some roster mismanagement issues. It just seems that if something's going to fall a program, a lot of times it's finding quarterback play. And great programs, you have bad quarterback play and you go from 10 wins to 7 wins. And LSU's been able to go from 10 wins to 8 wins, which, yay. But still at the same time, which, I mean, it shows the quality of the program that Les Miles has built, but that excuse has run pretty thin with everybody.
Yeah.
You can miss on one, and it's been great that he was able to miss on one quarterback and still stay competitive. And I think a lot of us were willing to spot him, the two-headed dumpster fire of Jefferson and Lee. The fact that it's kind of happening again is really frustrating. And now you see there's another third wave coming that they don't have a plan after Harris is beyond infuriating.
Yeah. Well, that's going to – I mean, that probably more than anything is what set people on fire. I mean, I don't – you might disagree, but whatever movement there was to fire Les beyond Joe Oliva and his cronies, you know, whatever movement from the fan base there was for that to happen, I feel like that is the primary issue. Well, not hiring Kevin Steele.
Yeah, the Kevin Steele hire, which, once again, good job. You really called that. to recap, I thought he was going to be Croton-esque and be good for 1 year and then descend into crap and we should stay far away. And you said there wouldn't even be one good year. We would just go directly to crap. So you definitely won that argument. And when the positive side of the argument wasn't that good, it's truly amazing that Kevin Steele was not even able to match my incredibly low expectations of being the defensive version of Gary Croton.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And, I mean, if you want to work on conspiracy theories, I guess, you know, did Steele want to take the Auburn opening? Obviously, there was some very good personal benefits to him. I don't know if he was encouraged by Les or not, but Les responded to that very well.
That is, on paper, probably Les Miles' best hire.
Yeah.
Dave Aranda did an outstanding job at Wisconsin. There is no other way to say it. Wisconsin is one of the best defenses in the country. He's had two Big Ten linebackers of the year, and we could certainly use that kind of linebacker play in Baton Rouge. And he does not get in the kind of talent that an Ohio State or a Michigan gets. So he's already behind the eight ball from he's behind the eight ball from the start from a talent standpoint, and he's turning less heralded recruits into better players and getting better results. He is one of the best defensive coaches in the country. What a great job. Just reacting right away. So did Les send Steele out? We'll never know. But that does fit what we know about Les Miles. He tends not to fire guys. He tends to find them jobs, much to Memphis's chagrin.
Well, and it's interesting too that he really went outside the box on this one. Like every other hire that I can think of, it made sense, like in his kind of fast lane. Like when he brought Pelini in, you know, he had connections there. Even hiring Chavis, they may have never worked together, but in the SEC, someone that's very familiar with the conference makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, Aranda is like a very outside the box hire from speaking of someone who either knows less or has worked with him or knows the SEC and has worked in the conference.
Actually, that's one of the things I like best about the hire, because one of the problems that we've both talked about over the past couple of years with this program is there's been a sense of complacency. I think the talent is there. We have had the quarterback issues, though I don't think they're as bad as people think they are from this season. I think Harris is going to be coming out of that. And actually, he had a pretty good year last year if you look at the numbers. But other than quarterback play, there's just kind of been a sense of complacency. If you look back at like the 2011, even the 2012 team, but definitely 2011, 2010, those teams tried to kill you. I mean, they were, you know, that's where you have the old thing, the gorilla with the 800 pound gorilla with a chainsaw for a penis kind of stuff. And that was even coined by an LSU fan. They were just a fun attacking team. And I think the team just kind of started to coast on reputation a little bit. And that happens. And even in great programs, Alabama is the great exception to this. And I think bringing in a guy, not just like Aranda, but just someone from outside the SEC, someone Les doesn't know personally, doesn't have tons of years with, doesn't have that kind of comfort with, I think you need that. You need a guy who can shake things up a little bit. And I forgot they were looking at someone before and they say, well, he might not take the job because he's known as kind of a jerk. I'm actually not against a jerk getting a job here. And that's where you look at who's going to take Wilson's job. Wilson's very well liked. And he's also one of the big recruiters. But I'm not against bringing in someone who's difficult to deal with, because we need some edge back in this. And not just on the field, but maybe in the meeting rooms. You need someone bringing up new ideas and saying, why do we do it this way?
Yep. Yeah, that's a really good point that I hadn't really thought about. I think everyone is, not incorrectly, but really focusing on replacing Wilson, the recruiter. You've seen a little bit of mention of replacing him as a coach, though a running back's coach is usually just, I mean, not to diminish the importance of the position, but it's the easiest position on the field to coach, the easiest position on the field to play. So, I mean, how much coaching really goes into that aspect? You know, most running back's coaches are ace recruiters, so that's why people are focused on that. But you're right. I mean, and Wilson's a guy that had Les's ear and was really trusted by him, so bringing in someone else that can maybe push him and continue to push the offense forward, it would be a really beneficial thing for the staff.
And while Wilson has a well-deserved reputation as a great recruiter, he's also a pretty darn good coach. Look at the guys he's put into the NFL. I mean, and we're not just talking stars that he's putting in the NFL.
Right.
He's putting in, you know, Alfred Blue is getting a ton of carries. Spencer Ware. It's not just Jeremy Hill who's lighting things up. He's been a very successful positional coach. And also, forget about NFL, like what they've done in the league, what they've done at LSU. LSU's running backs have been very productive. They don't fumble a lot. They get a lot of yards per carry. He's really good at mixing up, playing the whole backfield by committee, and, you know, having a bruiser and then having another kind of scat back type, and then kind of having your all-purpose guy. His running backs block. They run. They tend to catch. There's a few that weren't able to. But they're really good at teaching a whole bunch of skills, and it's served them well at this level and the next. So as much as people talk about Wilson the recruiter, and I don't want to take away from that because he is a great, great, great recruiter, he's a heck of a coach. At least that's what he's shown. I think it does kind of diminish the position to say, oh, well, we're just going to miss him for the recruiting. And I know that's not what you're saying, but that is kind of the vibe that I feel that's kind of floating around. How are we going to replace his recruiting? Okay, we'll do that with Ed Orgeron. That's how we replace it.
Yeah.
But that's not, I think, what I'm most worried about with Wilson. It's more about who's going to be the next coach who comes in. Though I do agree that the running back coach has to be a very good recruiter.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because when you bring that up, that I think back to the Larry Porter days, and I can remember people being angry with the way he rotated the backs. We've always kind of rotated backs, but I can remember people being frustrated with his choice of rotation, whether it was down and distance or just going away from someone that was maybe hot. Like, I think that Kentucky game in 07 when we won the title.
Yes.
Charles Scott's just running mad, and they keep going back to a clearly beaten down, exhausted Hester, which, God love him, great player, but he needed
That's the one time he didn't convert. If you remember that game, fourth and two, I think it was, he didn't convert. That was a big knock on Porter. And you look at how the backs were used this year. Geis just always seemed to come in at the exact right moment. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Fournette was the hammer. He's hammering and hammering. And then all of a sudden, Geis comes in there, and it's just a different gear that he has. I mean, I'm not saying Geis is a better back than Fournette, because he's not. But Geis is an incredible player in his own right, and he's definitely faster.
Yes.
And he's got a more quick. He's got a little bit more wiggle. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a quicker player, and it's like all of a sudden you've been playing this ferociously violent player who's seeking out contact, and then all of a sudden there's this guy you can't catch, and who can also lay. I mean, he can still lay down the wood on you. It just frustrated defenses to no end. You could kind of see it. It's like, oh, we finally got Fournette out of the game, thank God. And then Geis would rush 30 yards, and they're like, this isn't fair. And then Daryl Williams comes in.
Yeah. We're just getting started.
I mean, like, Wilson did a great – he had a lot of tools, and that's, you know, to his credit, he's the guy who brought in those tools, but he really used them real well. He wasn't one of those kind of coaches, oh, when all you have is a hammer, all you see is a nail. Mm-hmm. Like, he knew that he had a drill and a screwdriver and, you know, a saw. Like, he was just – he used the whole toolbox. I'm a really big fan of how we used our running backs.
Yeah. I mean, from what Billy said today, he doesn't expect any movement on that hire till post-signing day, which makes some sense. And I saw that Austin Thomas is out on the road because I had missed this, but apparently they changed the NCAA rules because previously if you were down a staff member, the head coach could actually take additional.
Yeah, that's what I thought. They changed that?
They changed it to now it's not the head coach, but a football staffer has to do it. So Austin Thomas was, I guess, the most logical choice. Very interesting.
And also, I think, don't quote me on this because, once again, you're much more plugged into recruiting. I don't think Frank Wilson has anyone left on the board of the last recruits that are on the table. Frank Wilson's not the head recruiter on any of them. So it does lend some credence that Les was pushing Frank Wilson to get a job this year. They had planned it out. Like, this was its time. The guy can't be our running back coach forever. I'm happy they got the job. And you shouldn't want to hold your guys back. And that's honestly one of the things I really like about Les, is that he's a very giving boss. We talk about the CEO coach all the time, and sometimes that's meant as an insult. But he really has done a good job as a CEO. He has identified talent and let them flourish and do what they do best. And then when they get another opportunity, he lets them go and you further their own career. He doesn't hold back talented people. And that's a good way to get people really frustrated. And that's just in any line of work.
Yeah.
He tends to get the most out of people. He has built the staff. And that's which so frustrating about the Kevin Steele hire, is that if you're going to be the CEO coach, you're going to get more criticism for your hires.
Yep.
Because that's what your reputation is. That's your number one thing. And the Kevin Steele hire, even how they went about it, if you go back and read what the two of us wrote while the hire was happening, even before they got Steele.
Oh, yeah.
You can just see the flames shooting out of our keyboards. We were both so mad the entire time. And it was a bungled search. And that, once again, I think goes back to the whole Les Miles complacency thing. And I'm not a fan of the coup, obviously, that was attempted by Oliva and his goons. I think that's a good way to call them. But the one thing I think it has done is it has lit a bit of a fire on Les Miles, because he's now the man. He won. There was a power struggle, and he won. And now he is taking this out for a spin. And I think there's a little bit more focus to Les since that Texas A&M game than there has been over the past 2 years. And that's a really good thing. And I wish it didn't take almost firing the guy to get there. But and I know this wasn't Oliva's intent. Hey, we're going to make the guy better by trying to fire him. But I think that's what happened.
Yeah. I think you've said this before. I know I have, that I want Angry Les, because I like Angry Les, because Angry Les is usually very focused and very, it's not like out of control anger. It's very like, oh, I'm going to put my wrath upon you.
Yeah, it's have a great day, Les. And that's where you have your Lester, you know. Lester is meek and sits in the back of the class and only speaks when called on.
Yep.
Turns his homework in on time. I mean, he's a good student, but he's just getting through. You know, we want to have a great day, Les. And that's, I think, what we're getting to right now. And that's where we also say is, you know, we're talking about, are we going to replace Frank? With the botched recruitment of Haskins, are we going to see a new offensive coordinator? Cam Cameron, they said we have a deal, but it hasn't been officially announced yet.
I find that peculiar. I mean, maybe I'm just, you know, shouting at the sky here, but I just think it's weird that they, like, why not? Les said they were working on it, and Cameron said they're working on it, or they have a deal or whatever, but for it to not be, like, they needed that to be announced almost to help recruiting. Because yes. I feel like one of the knocks would be, did you see? Like, he may not even be there. They already tried to fire Les. Like, they need every sign of stability they can offer. And they didn't do that. I mean, is he quibbling over dollars? Or, I mean, I don't understand.
And he's one of the highest paid coaches in the country. So there's not a whole lot of place for his salary to go up to.
Yeah.
It's not like Cam has the ability to go to LSU and say, hey, I want a 10% raise.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious too, is if they are working on the deal, does he take a pay cut? Because I wouldn't say he deserves what he's getting.
Yeah, it's hard to cut a guy's pay though.
Yeah, it is. Especially, and you know, Les wouldn't do that because Cam is his good friend. So I don't think you do that to any of his coaches, much less one that is he's especially close to personally.
But I do agree with you. I think there's a chance that after signing day, once Cam Cameron doesn't bring anybody in, and, I mean, that they announce that he's not going to be the coach next year.
And they can do it pretty amicably because his contract runs up, and they can just say, well, we tried, and he wants to go to the NFL or something like that.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is once we get through the NFL – maybe that's what the holdup is, hey, I want to see if I can get an NFL gig. And once again, that's how Les Miles gets rid of coaches. He gets them to a better gig. And maybe there's going to, you know, there's always coach changes in the NFL after Super Bowl season. And they have a hiring freeze during the playoffs, right? You can't make any coaching changes now.
You can if they're not in the playoffs.
Okay, so the teams outside the playoffs can, but anyone in the playoffs can.
Yeah, but still, like, so many teams are still finalizing their staffs, and people barely have head coaches hired, much less their entire staff.
And then they have I know there's, like, a lockdown on news. Like, the NFL is good about, like, you're not allowed to announce anything, like, the week of the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
there's all sorts of – the NFL is so tight-ass that that's
– It is.
I mean, speaking of which, though, like, for a league that – is the no fun league. This was a fun weekend of football. I'm not going to lie. It's not college bowl game season. You know, but the college bowl game season was kind of a dud, at least the second half of it. But these were enjoyable games. I actually found myself liking the NFL for a weekend.
Yeah, I did. I've watched most of Packers Cardinals, which was really, really entertaining. And then bits and pieces of the other ones. Was there any other game that really stood out to you? I watched some of the Seahawks game, but that was kind of – the first half was just
– I totally missed the first half. We were doing something with the kids. I think we were at the playground or something like that. We came back, and it was 31-0. We're like, we're not going to watch this. So, you know, we got lunch, and, you know, we put the kids down. And then, like, I turn on the TV just because, hey, let's just turn on. And it was like 31-14, but the Seahawks had the ball. We're like, let's sit down and watch it. Let's just cuz. And then all of a sudden it turned into like this really exciting game down the stretch. So if you don't watch the first half, like that game was really fun. But if you watch the first half, I could see how you might have flipped the channels.
Yeah.
And then the Denver game, you know, Denver-Pittsburgh was really exciting. You know, to see Peyton Manning slowly fall apart before our eyes. He is like the picture of Dorian Gray, but only he is the picture.
That's a really good analogy.
They brought the painting out of the attic and then sitting in midfield and just slowly degrading. And what I like about the Cardinals, other than the fact, you know, that's Patrick Peterson. I wish Tyrann Mathieu was healthy and Kevin Minter's on that team. I'll be honest. I really like seeing Carson Palmer.
Yeah.
Because he's a guy who early in his career looked like he was going to be great. And if you remember when he first got in the NFL, he was outstanding his first couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
And then the Steelers hit him below the knee on a really dirty hit. And blew out his knee, and it completely changed his career. And you know, he's never been the same player. And he's never even gotten back to an all-pro level, much less that Hall of Fame kind of level he was on early in his career. So it's nice to see a guy in the twilight of his career who kind of had his career robbed from him by an illegal play have this kind of success, like, right at the end. So I'll be honest, as much as I want to say I'm rooting for the Cardinals because it's, you know, the LSU connection on defense, I'm rooting for the USC guy. I really like Carson Palmer. I am a traitor on that one. I really wish good things for the guy. As I get older and I watch sporting events that I don't care about as much, like, because I don't have a connection to any team.
Yeah.
I care about those human interest stories. I'm sorry. I'm soft. And as I get older, I view them as human beings.
Yeah.
And Carson Palmer was a guy, I feel bad for him. He should have had a better career. And as a fan, I feel like we've been ripped off of his career. And that's another reason I hate the Steelers. So I'm glad they lost the Broncos. So it all tied together.
I feel that way about Larry Fitzgerald too. Just one of like the league's great guys.
Yeah, yeah.
He should have his moment. I mean, he's had a great career. So it's not like
Fitzgerald's definitely on the list of. And also, I just like that. He was so awesome. That you know had that big catch in overtime. It was just it's just a team of good dudes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know outside of LSU fandom, Patrick Peterson's not the most popular person in the world, but you know Neil before Zod, he's a super villain. You're not supposed to like him.
And they have a great comeback story with their coach too, who was like run out of the league at 59 years old, and now he's 60 something, having a total resurgence.
And see, and that you know that's what we need less to have. He almost got run out, and it's time for the resurgence. But. And, you know, I just mentioned resurgence. It is kind of ridiculous we're talking about resurgence when LSU is still one of the most successful programs in college football. And it just speaks to just how spoiled we are as fans.
Yes.
As I like to say, this is what success looks like. I know we have this unreasonable standard of going on at Alabama right now. And in a way, we should appreciate what's going on at Alabama because this is one of the great dynasties in the history of college football going on right now. They've won 4 titles in 7 years. The last team to do that was Notre Dame back in the 40s.
And I feel like so many of our fans waste their breath trying to argue it's not a dynasty. I'm like, come on, guys.
Not only is it a dynasty, it is the greatest dynasty in college football history.
And they're going to be there next year, too.
Yeah, because if you look at the dynasties, four out of seven – Notre Dame 1940s, I honestly don't count stuff before World War II. Sorry, Michigan. I just don't. It's a different game, and also there just weren't a whole lot of teams playing.
Yeah.
And honestly, college football doesn't really get going for me personally until about 1980 because that's when the SEC really had integrated. Herschel Walker is my line. But if you still want to include like the 50s and the 60s and 70s, and there was a lot of great football being played, like Bud Wilkerson never did this. And we're talking about – I mean, Bear Bryant never did this. We are talking about the legends of the game never have done. And it's a more competitive era right now. You have a playoff you have to go through. There's more good teams just because it used to just be Notre Dame was the only team on national television. They got everybody.
Yep.
And then the Deep South, Alabama was Alabama, and they got everybody. Like, there are much more roadblocks and more factors that encourage parity than ever before. And – Nick don't care. I hate the guy. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and talk about how much I like Nick Saban because I don't. But I do – I'm impressed by what he's doing. I mean, he makes a great villain.
I'm already imagining the vitriol that will be spewed your way in the comments tomorrow just for acknowledging their greatness.
Oh, they're going to hate my guts. But the thing is, like, no one hates Vanderbilt. It's that simple. They're worth hating. You're delusional if you start talking about how Alabama's not any good.
Yeah.
They're great. That's why I hate them. Like, that's the starting point. You hate great teams because they're our rival. And also, they do a lot of things that are just infuriating. I do think some of the early part of their dynasty was built off of easier scheduling than we had. I think – everyone says, oh, just change one result on the field. Forget about changing results on the field. If Alabama doesn't get the vote to go the way they want it to in 2011, they don't win the 2011 title. And then they might not go to the 2012 title game because that was a carryover from 2011. Oh, well, they're going back-to-back, and they got the default. Yeah. I mean, so you only have to change a result, and they could have lost two titles. So, yeah, there's been some luck there. But as Branch Rickey told us, luck is the residue of design. So as much as I want to hate Alabama, I mean, as much as I want to say Alabama's done this with smoke and mirrors, they haven't. This is a legitimately great program, and it's one of the greatest of all time, and it's in our backyard. And that just makes us look at what LSU is doing and kind of pish-posh it and be like, oh, well, Alabama's winning 13 games every year, so why can't you do that, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, that's just an unreasonable standard. And I don't mean that because they're Alabama. I mean because what they're doing right now is just insane, and they'll never do it again. So appreciate it, hate it, whatever. That's not the standard. If you look at what LSU is doing and compare it to any other school in the country over the last 5 years, last 10 years, they're one of the most successful programs in the country. This is what success looks like. Oregon took a step back. Ohio State had a couple of years where they didn't win a few. USC took steps back. Texas is currently having a downturn. Florida State, you know, up and down. It happens everywhere.
Yeah,
and honestly, it'll happen at Alabama. It just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah,
but absolutely. LSU, they've managed to have their downturn only be we win 8 games, we win 9 games, and that's fantastic. If that's your trough, you're an outstanding program, and that's the level that Miles has gotten us to. But man, you look to next year. Oh my God, I mean, this team is really set up to be a great team next year.
Yeah, I mean, I in my piece that's running tomorrow, I guess I shouldn't divulge information, but I made the argument, you know, if you blindly just put the team down in front of someone, a good college football fan that knows the game, without saying this is LSU, you just say, hey, they're returning 18 starters, they have one of the top defensive coordinators in the country, their quarterback is a junior, they have probably the best player in the country as their running back. Every single college football fan in the nation is going to say, yep, they're going to be excellent, like probably contend for the national championship.
Yeah.
But it seems like the prevailing attitude is like, we got stupid Cam Cameron still. We got Les Miles still. No way we're going to win.
Or it's like, we'll just wait and see. No, this is not a wait and see year.
No.
Returning 18 starters and almost all of your offensive and defensive production does not happen. Because the guys we're losing, outside of Debo Jones.
Who was nothing before this year.
To be honest, we were talking a year ago, like, oh, when's Debo ever going to show up? And, okay, we're losing two offensive linemen, and that's going to hurt. But you still return 3 of 5, and in a way the injuries on the line from this year help going forward because now a lot of guys have played.
And they're still trying to keep Hawkins. He hasn't signed with an agent.
Really? Okay, so that's I thought at 4 o'clock today it was done.
You submit your papers at 4, but you can pull them back by, like, noon on Saturday, I think Ross Dellinger reported.
Okay, like so I thought the 4 o'clock was the deadline for everybody. All right, if he hasn't signed with an agent, all right, let's
There's still a furious pitch to keep him in Baton Rouge for another year.
Honestly, getting Beckwith back was the big one.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled Trey White's coming back because, honestly, it does irritate me when someone gets the number 18 and leaves as a junior. Unless you're just truly – if Leonard Fournette was going to wear 18, okay, whatever.
Right.
But I like the fact that Trey White wearing 18 is coming back. Because it shows some commitment to the program.
Yeah. And he's always been a kid that's valued his academics. And since he was a recruit, it was always something he talked about. So it's nice to see some follow through on that. And I think it, barring disastrous injury, knock on wood, he'll be fine.
Yeah.
The best recruiting job of the year so far is Aranda convincing Beckwith to stick around.
Yeah, because Beckwith, there's not a whole lot of room for him to move up the board. And also, they're going to change defensive systems on him. They're going to be a 3-4 next year. And they were supposed to be a 3-4 this year, so I guess he kind of, sort of, a little bit played 3-4 this year, but I didn't really see it. And we had some three down linemen.
Yeah.
But there was no linebacking support behind him, so we pretty much played two linebackers all year.
Yep.
So Beckwith is taking a risk, but I do agree that we kind of overstate the risk. They say, oh, well, he could get hurt. Okay, how many players have gotten hurt and it's killed their draft?
Yeah.
Most players get hurt and they still get taken anyway.
Yep.
I mean, you have like Lattimore, who just had a devastating injury.
Yeah, and that's just so off the charts, though.
Yeah, but like I don't want to say that's the list, but that kind of is the list. Yeah. There's not a whole lot of guys. Because what if he comes back, even if he blows out a knee, which God forbid, all right, blows out a knee, he's still going to get taken in the second round.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to be like, oh, because injuries happen in the NFL.
Right.
So there's no personnel guy going, well, this guy's got a bad knee, so we're not going to have him on our team. Are you kidding me? Like, NFL personnel guys don't think that way. They think that everybody's an injury risk. You know, and everybody on their team has a busted knee. There's no one fully healthy out there. So,
yeah, those knee injuries these days are just – it's like going to get a tooth pulled almost. Absurd how quickly they flip them around.
They're in such good shape, and they've got such great facilities and stuff like that. Yeah, it's different than you or I blowing out a knee. If I blow out a knee again, I'm going to be on the Rascal. You know? And I am looking forward to my days on a Rascal, so don't you?
I think you're young yet for that.
Yeah, but still, would you like to have a little motorized thing with a little basket? You know,
would be nice.
Yell at people, get off my lawn. So...
You're rapidly approaching those years.
Yeah, I am definitely hitting into my cranky old years, and this is where we transition off of football. See, look, this is I attempt a segue.
That was nice.
I was even gonna make a Golden Years joke, so we can talk about Bowie. But my heroes are dying at this point. Like, it's a real reminder of my own mortality, and they're older than me because these are still people who have always been there, but. David Bowie and Alan Rickman. Today, Glenn Frey, not quite as significant to me personally, but I'm sure there's an Eagles fan somewhere, and I don't want to insult Eagles fans. Yeah, actually, I do. The wrong Eagle died. I didn't put that on Twitter, but I'll say that now because Don Henley, you know, screw that guy. But no, I mean, Glenn Frey was actually fairly beloved, and he's a great musician, but he didn't mean anything to me, so that one didn't tug at my heartstrings.
No emotional tie.
Yeah, it'll tug at someone else's, and that's kind of what's cool about the world. Everybody's kind of in their own thing. But Bowie, for me, was just huge. Like, I didn't think Bowie could die. He's just a guy who's always been there, and he's always remade himself, and he's always been there. Because when I was born, he was already a star. And what's interesting about Bowie is just constantly remaking yourself has now become a thing. Like Madonna did it. And that's just how people are famous now. You know, you go through one phase and you go through your next phase and you go, but it's sort of like David Bowie did that first, and he sort of turned his whole life into an art project, and at the end he almost turned his death into an art project. Now, his last album, I don't know if you've seen the video, but it's very much him saying goodbye, and it's
I read about that. I haven't watched it yet.
It's this guy saying, "Hey, I'm dying. And this is what death is like." And it's really kind of remarkable. And what I love so much about that is that Bowie is most people in the mainstream's gateway into weird stuff. And so...
As a fan?
Yeah. Like, he's the guy that when you first encounter... People know who Bowie is. If you turn on classic rock radio, you're going to hear a Bowie song. You've probably heard Heroes.
Sure.
You know, you've heard Fame. You've heard Golden Age. You know, you might know China Girl, Let's Dance. You know, you're going to know the hits. And so even – I know you're not a huge music fan. You know who Bowie is. Like, he's a figure for you, and even beyond Labyrinth. But he's people's gateway into other stuff because you find out there's this guy – and he's done all this weird stuff. And then you're like, oh, well, he talks about how he wanted to Ziggy Stardust as a combination of Iggy Pop and Lou Reed. So I got to find out who Iggy Pop and Lou Reed are. And so then, you know, this is kind of how I went. And I was like, so I got Lou Reed's couple of albums. I was like, wow, this Lou Reed guy is amazing. Mm-hmm. And But I also got into Iggy Pop. And so I was like, oh, Iggy Pop was in Iggy and the Stooges. And that's how I got into punk. I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest stuff ever. Like, just fuzzed out guitars, a lot of yelling. And, you know, it was, you know, 14-year-old me, like, that was perfect. And that is the service that Bowie gave to people. He was a person. Even though he was world famous, he was personal to people. It was just like, he's the guy who said, he was the celebrity who said, you're weird and that's okay.
So there's an accessibility there.
Yeah.
Even though he's certainly a fringe type artist. Like, he's not a mainstream. I mean, he is mainstream, but he's not. His work isn't mainstream, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like he never had a number one album until now. And, right. But at the same time, like, everybody knows who David Bowie is. It wasn't like I had to call my mom and explain who David Bowie was.
No, of course.
And I find that interesting that he's this incredibly famous figure, and people know a few of his songs. But people who are really into Bowie, there's just all this other stuff. And he's really a guy who, when I was a kid, meant a ton to me. Like, he was a guy who said it was okay to do weird things. And also, it was cool to not be popular.
Yeah, sure.
Like, David Bowie, like, my favorite David Bowie album is Diamond Dogs. I love Diamond Dogs. And even among Bowie fans, that's not considered his best album. Like, that's considered kind of a throwaway album, not a ton of, and to me, I just love that album. And
why do you love that particular album?
Mainly because I like the fuzzed out guitars on it. I like it, it's a little more aggressive than his other stuff. Like, Bowie's got, I mean, he's got that, you know, see, he has such a clean voice, is the best way to say it. And I'm not really into clean sounding music. I don't really like high production values and stuff like that. I like my rock and roll to be dirty. You know, I want it to sound like it was recorded in a garage. One of my theories is, like, I want music that can be created by four kids in a garage, because I view rock and roll as American folk music.
Okay.
It's modern folk.
I like that.
It's the story of just it's for everybody. Anybody can make it. Anybody can listen to it. And it's the same way. That's why I consider hip hop part of rock and roll's tradition, because anybody can make it. I mean, clearly, there are people who are good at it and people who are bad at it. But it was, once again, something that was just kids on the street who just came up with rhymes and, you know, had some old records and they started, you know, scratching them together, stealing some beats out of them, and then, you know, you had a whole genre. And I like that kind of thing. So Bowie, his more considered great albums are a little bit cleaner and they have a lot of production values. He worked with guys who really did... And they did some really cool stuff, but I'm not as into that, is the best way to say it.
Gotcha.
So, but I like the fact that he said it was okay. Like, whatever Bowie you like is yours. And that's kind of what I liked about him. He was very, and I keep going back to the fact that it's personal. Like, it's, and what's funny is he's not my favorite of artist of all time. I'm not, like, I know I have friends who are much bigger David Bowie fans than I am. Sure. Actually, sister-in-law. I actually went as Aladdin Sane to Christmas a few years ago. I mean, to Halloween. I mean, she is a huge Bowie fan. I'm just kind of on the chart. And but everything, it was kind of the permission that I like. And because when you're a kid and you're just trying to figure out who you are, here's this guy who was just like, well, guess what? You can be literally anything. And I think that's kind of amazing. And that's where you get into another guy who's beloved, Alan Rickman.
Yeah, I was just going to segue into that, and I'm probably a little more equipped to talk about Alan Rickman.
Yeah, I dominated that one. I'm sorry about that.
No, like, I wanted you to, because...
something. I'm trying to verbalize why he meant something to me.
No, it helps me understand.
And but yeah, Rickman...
But I mean, I think you saw this too, but really the outpouring on Rickman was so interesting because... it seemed like every other person that mentioned him had a different favorite role.
That's one thing I noticed. And also, he didn't have a major film role, I think, until he was 40. I think he was about 40 years old when he played Hans Gruber in Die Hard.
I think I saw today he didn't start acting until he was 28.
And that's amazing to me. And, like, and I think that's so great that he burst onto the scene fully formed. And like he came and he was like the go-to guy to be, you know, Euro trash villains.
Right.
Like it's almost a kind of villain. It's the Alan Rickman. And it's funny, over the last couple of days we've been watching Alan Rickman movies, my wife and I. You know, we've been trying to, you know, pay tribute to the guy, because he did. He, you know, he's a guy who's always kind of been there. And of course the Harry Potter movies, he was Snape for a whole generation. And I like the books, but that performance didn't mean as much to me as it did to other people. But once again, it's the personal thing. It's whatever.
Where do you connect?
Yeah, where do you connect? And for me, the two roles I go back to, and you can have your two, but for me, it's Truly Madly Deeply, where he plays a ghost that the dead lover of his girlfriend, and he comes back, and then she starts to see him, and at first she's ecstatic that he's there, and then his flaw starts being revealed, and he's kind of annoying, and like you idealize something when it's gone, and when you come back, you're reminded of its flaws and its imperfections, and eventually she has to move on. And I think that role is it's really a moving movie, and it's not one of his more well-known pictures.
I've not seen that.
So you should. That is my big thing. Truly Madly Deeply, find it. It is a great movie. It's late 80s. You got to get past that. It's, you know, very British. And that's why I seen it, because my mom is like part British, I swear. But the other one I really liked was Galaxy Quest, because in a way I think that's Alan Rickman. Because I know in the way he's playing a Leonard Nimoy type, that, you know, Leonard Nimoy famously wrote an autobiography of I Am Not Spock. And then later in his life, came back and wrote I Am Spock. Alan Rickman, I don't think, ever quite had that problem of being Hans Gruber, even though that's how everyone knew him. He also was in the Royal Shakespeare Company. He was this classically trained, you know, he had been this actor who had done great things on the stage. But no one who ran into him on the street knew him as Alan Rickman, the actor. They knew him as Hans Gruber, the guy, you know, who shot Bruce Willis. And actually, he didn't shoot Bruce Willis. He couldn't get his gun out in time. And I just thought that was kind of a weird way, a personal film without being a personal film. And also, it's just funny as heck. I love Galaxy Quest.
Oh, it's a great movie.
What were yours?
I mean, I love Hans Gruber. Die Hard, I think, is just one of the everlasting action movies. We won't let you go into your screed about it being not a Christmas movie.
It's not, but it's okay. That's...
I mean, I remember him so many, like, he's even memorable in Robin Hood, which is not a great movie, but it's a movie.
But what was amazing is when he died, it was the outpouring of emotion was so much that, you know, you have the thing from Daniel Radcliffe saying mm-hmm. he was the first actor on set who treated him like an actor and not a little kid. And he was just you got the sense that he was just a decent, good person.
Yeah.
And you like to hear that about your idols, if that makes sense. You know, and this is my Kirby Puckett story, because when I was a kid, Kirby Puckett was one of my favorite baseball players. And I loved Kirby Puckett, even though I was an Oriole fan, you know, because everyone loved Kirby. And then when he died, all these stories came out that it turned out that he was kind of a sociopath.
Yeah.
And, you know, he beat his wife, and he was just an all-around horrible human being. So part of the lesson of that is that we don't know these people.
Yeah.
They craft these images, and, you know, we don't know celebrities or athletes. You know, they don't belong to us. And in a way, that's true, but in a way, it's not. Because you can at least get a – while I was completely wrong on Kirby Puckett, you always got a sense that – like David Bowie was a generous person to others because of how he had treated people and how he had helped other people's careers out. There were so many stories of all the people he had helped. And same with Alan Rickman. There was just all these stories that he was just a good guy. And honestly, same with Glenn Frey. There were, you know, stories about Glenn Frey as being the member of the Eagles that was actually, you know, nice to everyone. I mean, even Don Henley likes him, and that's almost impossible. and you – so even though you don't know these people – they're in your lives, you know.
Yeah.
You buy their records, you know, you see their movies, you know, in sports, you know, you watch their games. So in a way, you have a piece of them, not a very large piece, maybe a bigger piece than they would like you to have, but you do have a piece of them. And you want that to be true. And it's nice to know that usually it is. It's not always true. Sometimes it's a lie. Sometimes it's a front. But I think more often than not, the face that we see is the face that we know. Like, no one's surprised that, you know, Sean Penn is, you know, just a pretentious gas bag. I mean, that's kind of come out. Like, he's not fooling people now.
And to bring this fully circle, I think it's part of the Les Miles, you know, character that I've heard people say before, like, I don't give a damn if he's a good guy. I just want a guy that wins. And it's like, well, I kind of do give a damn if he's a good guy. Like, I like that Les seems like a pretty fundamentally decent guy.
I agree with that. I think that's the big difference, is that I think when Nick Saban retires, there's nothing in his life other than football.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a fabulously successful football coach, but in a way that's kind of sad. I don't feel that he has any interests outside of football. And Les, I feel that he'll have a very full life the moment he walks away. And I think he'll have tons of other interests. I don't think he's famous for being a football coach, but at the end of the day, I don't think being a football coach defines who he is as a person.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
You know, he falls in that Dean Smith category of coaches. You know, they're coaches, but they're people.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that other coaches aren't people, but Nick Saban falls more into that Woody Hayes category of, this is all he cares about. And yeah. Look, if that's how he wants to live his life, that's how he wants to live his life. He doesn't have to run it past me or us of, you know, how, or maybe that's what makes him happy. It is not our place to judge that. But at the same time, it does seem kind of sad and empty.
I think we do. He is mischaracterized at times of being so robotic.
Yeah, I don't think he is.
And, you know, like, even believe it if you want, I don't know. But, like, they came up, it was a press conference earlier this year or end of last year, talking about him leaving Alabama. And he was like, well, my mom lives here. And, you know, I got three kids here and we've built a home here and all this, like, he was touching on very sentimental reasons to stick around, not like, well, it's great to be at Alabama, why would I go to, you know, there's no better job in the country kind of shit. It was like, hey, I got a family here. That's not easy to just uproot and move on from.
We lose sight that they're people, and I think Saban was right to make that point when he says, like, look, I'm a human being, damn it. I just think he's a human being that cares so much about football. Like, I would be shocked if Nick Saban came into a press conference and started talking about anything except football. And Les Miles, he could literally talk about anything and it would not surprise me. And I think that's kind of the difference I'm getting at. Absolutely. I'm not saying this makes Nick Saban a bad person.
No.
I don't want to disappoint LSU fans, but I mean, I don't think Nick Saban is a monster who eats children. I just don't. I'd like to believe that. If that's true, someone please find out about that so we can throw him in jail.
It's got to be a picture.
Yeah, get that program, you know, send it to the iceberg. But, you just want the image that people put forth to be real. And honestly, I think some people just aren't that good of a liar. And actually, most people aren't. It's hard to live that much of a lie. Like, you look at things of Leonard Fournette, and I think Leonard Fournette is a genuine guy. I think this is a guy who really wanted to come to LSU. I think his celebrity is important to him. Yeah. That it means something. I think he wants to be a symbol to New Orleans. I think Katrina is really a motivating factor in his life.
Absolutely. You know,
and could he just be full of crap and he's just trying to, you know, get ready for his big endorsements once he graduates here? Yeah. It's there is a possibility of that. I've never met him. So clearly he could be lying to all of us. But if he is lying to all of us, he's doing a really good job. Like, and it's sort of like, to go to the Kurt Vonnegut thing, if you pretend to be something for so long, eventually you become that thing.
That's very true.
See how I could actually, I brought back the Mother Night. Look at that. See, we bring the esoteric literary references here that I can't drop on the blog, or I do, but no one gets them. I just kind of slide them in every once in a while.
It's going to fly right by most people.
Yeah, but yeah, go read a Kurt Vonnegut novel. Mother Night, good one. Or the if you don't like reading, go see the movie. Nick Nolte was in it. And that's a guy, we could be talking about in a year or two.
We're at just over an hour, but we'll probably pare it down some. But I was going to take the opportunity to potentially – you've given Alabama a lot of love in this podcast. Not that it's undue.
Very unlike me.
It is very unlike you. But I might steal your villain moment because I'm going to confess that I've never read a Harry Potter book or seen a Harry Potter movie. But even worse than that, some people are going to hate me for that. I've never seen Labyrinth.
Oh, my God. We actually watched – I showed my daughter Labyrinth this weekend.
I saw you post a status about it on Facebook.
Yeah, and she actually, we actually had the whole conversation of the he has the power of voodoo. And she hadn't even seen the movie yet. And she said, hoodoo? And I was like, you do.
Yeah, when you wrote it, I read it and I was like, that's funny. I don't get it, but that's funny.
She actually was able to do the goblin part without having seen the movie. So she's that in tune with David Bowie. Look, I'm a big Muppet fan, and Labyrinth is from the Jim Henson Creature Shop, so you should see it because it's one of the best examples of puppetry in film, and I really mean that. It's like, forget about the Bowie part. It's great puppetry. There's a scene, the Helping Hand scene is just amazing. I can just watch that, and I'm mesmerized by the hands. I don't think it's as good as Dark Crystal, to be perfectly honest, if we're using doing Jim Henson Creature Shops. And look, it's kind of a hokey 80s film. There's some definite 80s bits to it. But then in David Bowie's got a tremendous codpiece in that movie. It can't be explained. If you haven't seen it, wow, it's pretty darn 80s. And he's got, this – it's a wig, but it's just a fabulous mullet. Labyrinth is beloved, but I wouldn't call it a great film. Like, sometimes you just got to admit some stuff we just love because we love. We saw it at the right time in life. Like, I hate to be the one to tell you this, Goonies is not that great of a movie.
No.
All right. That said, I love Goonies and I watch it like every year because it's Goonies. And I saw it when I was 10 years old and I'll always love Goonies. But let's be honest, not a good film. Labyrinth is sort of that level. You might have missed it because you weren't there. You might be too old to now see Labyrinth and be like, oh, this is a great film. Harry Potter's, yeah, you should probably. It's a really good children's book. And honestly, it gets better as it goes along. And Snape is honestly a really good character. I'm on Team Snape. So,
I think it's a good this is a good way to wind it down because we can see if people make it to the end of this.
Yeah, we'll find out if you haven't seen Labyrinth or read any of the Harry Potter stuff. I mean, look, if it's not the thing you like, it's not the thing you like. I mean, it's a fantasy series written for children. Let's not kid about what it is. I happen to like fantasy novels, so it works out pretty well for me. And honestly, the first couple books are clearly aimed at children. The series doesn't really come into its own until about the third or fourth book.
I think when it was growing in popularity, it was the height of my snobby English major.
Oh.
So I was like, that's just children's literature. Why would I ever waste time reading that? Why do you think that's great literature? Which is not my personality at all now. So I'm glad I've grown out of that stage.
Yeah, and like you have to go through that stage. I think that's an important stage for everyone to go through. So if you know someone who's in high school or college and they just look down on everything – it's important that they go through that because that's how they spend a couple of years discovering stuff that's great. But then they come back to Earth and, they realize that some stuff's just fun.
Yeah.
Not everything – it's sort of like how Graham Greene wrote both Hollywood screenplays and great novels. And he called his weaker books – he called them his entertainments. I mean, there's something to be said for just a good yawn.
That's true.
And honestly, I think that's something that a lot of art films – forget. They forget character or just spinning a good yarn. They'll have all these great visuals and then there's nothing behind it.
Yeah. And
you kind of need both.
Or God help us that it could actually be an art film that's fun.
Yeah, like you're not allowed to smile.
Right.
And I think that's a real shame that art is like this plotting unhappiness thing. And like if you're going through your big snobby literature period, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole in this one, but like you could read a book like The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wayo. That's a fun book. It's great, and it, you know, won all sorts of awards. And but at the same time, there's some fun in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some violence and terrible things as well. But not everything has to be, you know, soul sucking and depressing to be considered art.
Which is really apt for award season. I think we'll probably have a whole episode about movie award season. I know you're not.
Yeah, I'm a year behind, but I can at least talk about it because I know what's going to win, you know.
Right. But, I mean, it's very true, like, especially with the Oscars. I think the Globes is a little bit different because they even have a comedy, devoted comedy categories, however much they skew them. But the Oscars, it's has a very much a tradition of if it's not a serious movie, it has no chance of being even considered a nominee.
Yeah, and that's and I think that's a shame that you can appreciate both high art and low art.
Yes.
I mean, you can be the same person. And look, I'm a big comic book fan, and look, some of it's junk. I still enjoy it, but I know when I'm reading something that's junk. But on the flip side, some comics have won, you know, the Pulitzer Prize. I mean, Mouse, you know, is, you know, a story about the Holocaust. It's, you know, incredible. And I'm reading something right now called Medium, which is really, really challenging. And I think people get caught up in the, oh, this is a blah, so it has to be terrible. Or even just a fun movie. Like, people will poo-poo just Star Wars just because it's, you know, Star Wars.
Right.
But God, what a blast. Like, how much fun was that movie?
That's very true. People don't like to have fun.
I love having fun. I'm a total hedonist.
It's my... It's kind of been, that was kind of my experience this year that I know I told you this offline personally, but I came to realize that I just wasn't having fun watching LSU anymore, and through no fault of LSU's, entirely my own. And it seems like a lot of people feel that way. It's unfortunate. Yeah,
and I think that's what we'll save for next week or next time we try this. So, yeah, we have no sign off right now. We don't have any sort of structure to this thing. As you can tell, we ramble all over the place, and I talk way too much because that's what I do.
Well, the special interest this week was really more tailored for you, anyways. Hopefully, next time I can counterpunch them.
Yeah, like we need to get you in there, and so we don't have a sign off yet, or even a beginning. So we'll have to think about that. But this has been the Sneaky Good Podcast. Hopefully it was sneaky good.